Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Slice of Healthcare. I'm your host, Jared Taylor. Very excited about today's guest, Dr. Richard Novak, a Stanford physician, board certified in anesthesiology and internal medicine. Dr. Novak has a long list of other roles as well, and he is the owner of theanesthesiaconsultant.com, which has a lot of great content on anesthesia. Very excited. So without further ado, let's get him on. Hi, Dr. Novak.
Greetings.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I wanted to start, if it'd be okay with you, giving the audience a little bit about your background, and then we can kind of start talking about why you chose anesthesia, and we'll go into some other subjects.
Sure. Right now, I practice anesthesia on a daily basis, but my background is I started as an internal medicine doctor at Stanford, and after being exposed to anesthesia specialists in the intensive care units at Stanford, I followed my training by doing a second residency in anesthesiology. In between the two, I was an emergency room attending at Stanford. So I've had backgrounds in all those fields. Right now, I practice operating room anesthesia. I'm also a medical director at a surgery center. And at Stanford, the anesthesia department is actually called the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative, and Pain Medicine. So in our line of work, perioperative means you're doing medicine before, during, and after the time of operations. And that's what my clinical life is like.
Interesting. I want to ask the big question. How do you manage all of that? That's a pretty big plate. And I know you have your blog, theanesthesiaconsultant.com as well. How do you manage to write articles and do all those different roles?
Yeah, I don't sleep much.
has it always been that way?
Pretty much. I also have three sons, and what I try to impress upon them is it's good to be ambitious. If there's a normal curve, I never want to be in the middle of the curve. I always want to push myself to do as much as I can. So that would be my answer to your question.
Interesting. Now, And I know you're also an avid golfer as well, correct?
Yeah, I play golf when I can. Certain times a year when we have club championships, I play every day for a period of time, and then the rest of the year I won't play very much because of my professional duties and my parenting duties. But yes.
Which of your roles would you say takes up the most of your time right now?
No question that my job does. I get up early every morning. I get to either the hospital or the surgery center about 7 in the morning. And I'm in an operating room off and on during the day. Our style of practice here in California is the physicians still give the anesthesia ourselves. Even though I work at Stanford Hospital, I am a full-time clinician, as I'm not supervising the residents at Stanford, and I'm not supervising nurse anesthetists. So it's another thing that's unique about my background. I've been doing anesthesia for over 30 years, probably done 25,000 anesthetics, and all 25,000 I've done myself. So unlike most academicians who have residents or someone else doing the clinical care, I've been working in an academic center, but I also do my own care. I'm in a private practice for anesthesia. So I'm an unusual hybrid in somebody who is like the community physicians who practice anesthesia around cases, yet I work in an academic center, so I'm a bit like a professor and a bit like a private practice person. I have a faculty title at Stanford, which I've had since the 1980s. Currently, I'm an adjunct clinical associate professor.
Interesting. Why'd you choose anesthesia? I know you went into a little bit, but could you elaborate a little bit onto what was the big thing that made you pursue that path versus the path that you were heading towards?
That's a good question. The fields of medicine, there are some dividing lines. And one of the dividing lines is whether you are working in a clinic or whether you're working in acute care. And I went to medical school at the University of Chicago, and they had an outstanding internal medicine department. And I thought that's what I wanted to do for a living. For an internship, I matched at Stanford. So I came here and began doing my internal medicine residency. What I found over the first 2 years is the majority of internal medicine is practiced in a clinic. You're listening to people talk about the sort of chronic problems and symptoms and illnesses we all have. You know, people have aches and pains, and they have high blood pressure, and they have chest discomfort or trouble breathing, or more often they're mild things like they're dizzy or they just don't feel very well. And it's a slow moving specialty. It's the sort of thing that you build relationships over time. So the main asset and emphasis of internal medicine is that over time you develop an interaction with a patient, a relationship with a patient that they trust you and you know them, and you learn what they need, whether it's an oral medication or a referral to another specialist. But it's not acute care. On the flip side, acute care involves specialties like surgery and anesthesia and emergency medicine and intensive care medicine. Those specialties, there's a lot more adrenaline. Things happen, they happen quickly. There are people's lives are at stake, minute to minute, second to second. And it's I found it to be less boring and quite stimulating. So I found myself leaving the clinic setting. And when I was exposed to intensive care units in the 1980s, the intensive care units at Stanford were run by the anesthesia department. And there's some outstanding role models. The professors that trained me, the ones that stayed here are still professors. The ones that left went to medical centers all over the United States, top notch, big name academic centers, and became chair people there. So they were really fine role models, and I wanted to be like them.
Interesting. Very interesting. I can tell you're very passionate about it too. Obviously, to be in it for the time that you've been in it, and to make that switch, obviously you had to be passionate about it, and it comes across right away. I want to go into. For those, I gave a little plug in the beginning about it, but your blog, theanesthesiaconsultant.com, for the audience, for any of the audience that have not seen this blog, it's very interesting. There's a lot of articles that are innovative, and I really like it, especially I look at Slice of Healthcare and what we're trying to do and what you're trying to do in anesthesia. I can really admire it. What made you start that blog, that site?
So about 15 years ago, I was elected to be the deputy chief of anesthesia at Stanford, and I served in that role for 15 years. It's a specific title, which meant I was the head of the private practice anesthesia practitioners at the University Hospital. And there were a number of obligations that came with the role. One is every month we'd go to the medical executive committee at the hospital, which is really interesting. We'd meet with the dean was there, the chief of staff, the CEO of the hospital, and all the department chairs. So I got to be in the midst of the governing process of a large, prestigious university medical center. In addition, the job was ill-defined because there's a chairman. Ron Perl is the chairman of anesthesia at Stanford. He's a colleague of mine for the last 30 years. He's an MD, PhD, and he's a terrific role model as well. The deputy chief didn't have any real governing role, and we were mainly clinical. So I decided to write because I've always liked to write. So I began writing a column. Initially, it was once a month in the department newsletter. And the emphasis of the column was very specific because, as I said earlier, I'm a private practitioner working in an academic medical center. I have viewpoints that differ from the professors because the professors, they teach with residents and they don't do their own cases. And the residents are working with professors and they're not doing the cases themselves either. But what happens the day you finish your training in anesthesia, you go out into what I would call the real world and you're on your own. And it's the most anxiety producing transition in the field of anesthesiology, because in anesthesia, if you make an error and you lose a patient's airway and you are unable to keep the patient oxygenated, and within 5 minutes, you can kill them. And everybody knows that, and there's a lot of denial, hoping that will not happen. But it's important that you're well prepared so that when those 5 minutes happen and there's no faculty member at your right elbow to save you, that you know what to do. So the initial articles that I wrote were clinical cases, what I would say, this and this and this happen, what do you do? And then the answer would come the next month. So they started with very simple things, like I would say you have a patient who's on an anticoagulant and you have a patient who's had a spinal anesthetic for a total hip surgery. And the next 2 days later, they have a spinal headache, meaning that they have a severe headache and they can't get out of bed or move around. But they're also on an anticoagulant. And what do you do? And the answer which would come out the next month would be, you do nothing until because they're on anticoagulant. The treatment for a spinal headache is to do a procedure on their back called a blood patch. But if you do a blood patch on a patient who has an anticoagulant, they could have a hemorrhage in their back and wind up paraplegic. So there were things that mostly there were clinical scenarios that I had seen either colleagues in my practice suffer through, or I did a lot of years of what we call quality assurance committee work or peer review work. Where it's fascinating, whether it was at the university hospital or elsewhere in a practice, you would hear all the complications and look through the charts and see where the mistakes were made. The good news is you would then learn for yourself how not to make those mistakes. And the process of quality assurance or quality improvement in medicine is really to work, not so much to chastise or punish those who made an error, but to inform and teach the next generation of people not to make those errors. So that's what my columns were. And after a number of years, I had gotten up to about 60 columns. And I was getting a lot of positive feedback from the residents, from the fellows, and the attendings on the full-time faculty. And I started my own website.
And you have quite a good amount of content on it over since you started.
Yeah, I think there's over 170 columns. Each one is in the ballpark of 1,000 words. So it's if it's 170 or 200,000 words, yes, that's several novels worth. And I write it all myself. I edit it all myself. And I'm proud of it. The readership crescendoed. I started the website in 2010. 2 years ago, I hit 1 million readers. And it's the pace right now is I have about 500,000 people per year looking at the website.
Wow. I've been on the website. I've read a couple of your posts that you've had. You have a pretty diverse, obviously all anesthesia related, but there's a pretty wide range of content on there.
There are, broadly speaking, there are two different types of posts. One of them is to inform lay people about what's going on in anesthesia. And the other is for anesthesia professionals, both MD anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists, to try to improve the art and craft and science of what they do. So for example, the top posts that get read on my website, the one that gets read the most every day is entitled, "How long will it take me to wake up from general anesthesia?" And what it is, it's an essay and just how anesthesiologists put patients to sleep and how they wake them up, what's involved with making the anesthetic stop, and how long it takes, what the time frame is for all those drugs, and what patients should expect, because patients have a lot of questions. The second most popular essay that's read is, "Will I have a breathing tube down my throat during the surgery?" And again, people have questions because they don't really know what they're getting into before surgery, and it varies. If you're going to have your gallbladder out, yes, you'll have a breathing tube. If your teenager is going to have their wisdom teeth out, no, they're not going to have a breathing tube. And people are interested. I find that there are a lot of very bright people in the field of anesthesiology. There are not that many people who are interested in writing or speaking. It's a bit of a shadow specialty where the physicians are behind the scenes. I mean, if your clients are always unconscious, it's possible to have an existence where your clients never know anything about you. Any anecdotes from friends, family, and readers that their anesthesiologist, they met them for 10 seconds before they went to sleep, and they don't remember anything about them, and they never saw them again, and then they got a bill. In many parts of the United States, a very acceptable model of anesthesia care is called the anesthesia care team. And in that model, one physician anesthesiologist will supervise a number of rooms, usually up to 4 rooms, each staffed by a certified registered nurse anesthetist. And this is an accepted model by the American Society of Anesthesiologists. We don't practice it very much in the Bay Area because we have a lot of MD anesthesiologists who want to live in the Bay Area. But in that model, you'll have a nurse anesthetist who tells you a little bit about the anesthesia, hopefully gives you an explanation what to expect. And then the anesthesia MD will come by and say hello and shake your hand and then walk away. So there isn't that much contact in some models with the physician anesthesiologist. So I think people don't know that much about the profession of anesthesiology, and they do have a lot of questions. And so that aspect of my website is to explain and enlighten the layperson. The other set of posts on my blog, which is about 60%, are aimed at the anesthesia professionals and how to do their craft at a higher level. Many of them, as I described earlier, are specific patient problems that are challenging and how one should handle that. And keep in mind, Jared, I'm just one individual. I believe I'm very well trained, but I am not a godlike authority in all things. So all my posts are a combination of what my experience and training has shown me, and there's always references from the current world's literature. I've become very comfortable and willing to look up references on every topic. So the whatever I say is not, this is what Rick Novak thinks, because that doesn't really matter as much as what does the world's literature in anesthesia say about this problem? You know, what are the treatments for postoperative nausea and vomiting? And what do you do when the serum potassium level is 3.9? Should you cancel the surgery or not? What if the preoperative blood pressure is 170 over 102? Should you cancel the surgery or not? So that's a long answer to a short question.
Yeah, it's I believe it's been a few months back since you and I first got in contact. But when I was first looking at your site, I believe I actually came across it by having an anesthesia question, which that's why I think there's not many sites like yours that actually there's really very few to none that explain the different things that are happening in anesthesia and some of the layman terms that it basically explains to people that don't know anything about anesthesia and that are concerned when they go into surgery. So I thought that was really cool that you started this up, and not that you just started it up, but that you've stayed active with it, which is obviously, you see all these blogs, they die pretty quickly, many of them, and you've been very consistent. So kudos to you, and thank you for keeping up with the content on that. I want to talk about, because this is when people go onto your site, they scroll down a little bit. You also wrote a book, and this it's a fictional book, correct?
That's correct.
And it's called The Doctor and Mr. Dillon. What made you write that? What's it about?
Yeah, well, I've always enjoyed writing, and I enjoy telling stories. The story of the Doctor and Mr. Dillon, it's a merge of two interests. One is my expertise in medicine, and the other is I grew up in a town named Hibbing, Minnesota, which was the hometown of Bob Dylan. And The Doctor and Mr. Dillon is a story of a murder that happens in that town. And two of the main suspects are the doctor, who is the first person narrator of the book, who stands trial for murder, and a nurse anesthetist whose name is Bobby Dillon, who is a psychotic individual who believes that he is the real Bob Dillon. And the book gives a lot of insights into Bob Dylan's music and history. But more importantly, it's an examination of what happens when there's an anesthesia complication and an ensuing legal trial. And it's a mystery.
And where is it available for anyone that wants to take a look or purchase
it? It's available for anyone on Amazon, yes.
Okay. All right. Anyone interested? It definitely sounds like an interesting story. And it just shows, I want to say out to the audience too about this. If you ever think you're busy, look at what Dr. Novak's doing and don't think you're busy. There's a lot of time, and I'm sure you'll agree with that, that you can get a lot done outside of just your current job. You can explore other interests and still get done what you need to get done. I would like to also, so along with writing, you said that's one of the things that you love. What else do you like to do for fun? We know you like to play golf. Are there any other things that you like to try to include in your life?
Well, I have three sons. They're 20, 18, and 12, and they all play tennis. So I can't beat any of them anymore, but I try to play tennis with them I take care of my yard and gardening because I like to be outside. I grew up in a snowbank in northern Minnesota, and now I live in a place that has green grass and palm trees year-round, so I like being outside. And I like to read. Those are probably the main things.
It's interesting. They all play. Now all three of them play tennis.
They do. I tried to encourage them to become golfers. When they were youthful, I read Earl Woods wrote a book called How to Train a Tiger. And I read the book to try to see how you could make your kids into a young Tiger Woods II. And it failed three times, but they're good kids. They're good tennis players. And they're,
well, you should be able to have some good doubles teams then, right? If there's three and then you. There you go.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
There you go.
I want to wrap up with just a few more questions. And this one is more from an advice standpoint. What would you say to either anesthesia students that are currently in school or that for interested students that intend to one day become anesthesiologist or become a part of the anesthesia field?
Yes. So the first line on my website is the profession of medicine offers a lifetime of fascination and no specialty is more fascinating than anesthesiology. And that's really how I feel about it. I thought about being a surgeon. I did become an internist. I worked in an emergency room. I worked with surgeons every day, pretty much other than being a psychiatrist or a pathologist. I see all the specialties because anesthesia crosses through obstetrics and cardiac surgery and brain surgery and pediatric surgery. I've done all those things. I think anesthesia is very interesting. It's a very popular specialty among medical students nowadays. In fact, as the field of medicine, you know, college students going into medical school is still a very popular path for a variety of reasons. Once within a medical school, when you have to make a choice, as I said, one of the first dividing lines is whether you want to be a clinic doctor or acute care doctor. Amongst the acute care specialties, surgery is still popular and anesthesia is very popular. I recommend it for a number of reasons. It's interesting. We do everything from newborns to 100-year-olds. We help deliver babies. We take care of cardiac transplants and liver transplants and every surgical specialty you can think of. So it's never boring. There's a phrase in anesthesia that anesthesia is 99% boredom and 1% panic. And I've always thought that was a fascinating statement, and it's somewhat true. Ideally, you want your anesthesia to be boring because everybody is stable and everybody wakes up and goes home and it's unremarkable. But no matter how good you are, 1% of the time, there will be things that happen that are very scary, and you have to act quickly, and you have to have a high tolerance for anxiety and adrenaline rushes, and you have to know what to do. So anesthesia isn't for everyone. So my advice to people was, yes, it's a fine specialty because it's interesting. People can make a very comfortable living, but it's not for everyone. Some people are best suited to sit in a clinic and listen. Others are ready to save someone's life within 5 minutes or not, and that isn't for everyone. There are a number of fine specialty programs in anesthesia around the country. And if you graduate from an American medical school and try to match within the specialty of anesthesia, you will probably have success getting a residency in an American program.
Where do you see the anesthesia market in 5 years?
That's another really interesting question. And there's a lot of posts on my blog and a lot of conversations on my blog about that because people want to know. You know, they don't want to invest their future in something that's going the wrong direction. There are some positive trends and some negative trends. On the positive trend, Americans are getting older. The baby boom that were born after World War II are now into their 60s and 70s, and they are requiring a lot of surgeries. So there's an increased volume of surgery, which means you need more anesthesia professionals. The negative aspect are in a number of states in the United States, there is now it's legal to have independent practice of anesthesia by certified nurse anesthetists. And it began with rural states such as Montana and the Dakotas, where they were not able to find MD anesthesiologists for every little town that had 18,000 people or 10,000 people. So the governors could opt out of the national requirement to have nurse anesthetists supervise. And in this setting, nurse anesthetists can give the anesthetics by themselves. That spread to California in the last decade. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed that into law in California about 10 years ago. Hasn't changed the practice of anesthesia as much in California as we feared. There are very few communities where nurses are giving the anesthesia by themselves. But that's one thing that that MD anesthesiologists are concerned about in the future, that they'll be phased out by nurses who are doing their profession for them. And it's a legitimate fear. I don't have a crystal ball. I think that excellent physician anesthesiologists will always have work to do somewhere. As with any economics, it's a supply and demand. If the supply of anesthesia providers grows and grows, then the reimbursement for them will decrease. And right now, the reimbursement for anesthesiologists is still high compared to other medical specialties. That data is available on my website and all over the internet. They can see what anesthesiologists typically earn. So I think it's a lucrative specialty, but it is, as I said earlier, it's stressful, and it is you have to have a high capacity for functioning under acute care adrenaline situations.
Do you foresee inpatient surgeries becoming less and less and emphasizing more on like outpatient surgeries?
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, in my practice, the majority of my practice is already outpatient surgery. And that's because over the decades that I've been an anesthesiologist, the improvement in anesthetics make people wake up more quickly. That helps. The improvement in monitors makes us be able to take care of patients more safely. And the improvement in surgical techniques, techniques such as laparoscopies and arthroscopies, make them minimally invasive surgeries to get the same job done. All these things add up to a trend where people don't need to stay overnight in a hospital. Decades ago, if you had your tonsils out, you'd stay in the hospital. In some places, they'd stay in the hospital for several nights. Now you have your tonsils out, in an hour and 15 minutes later, you're in your car. Somebody's driving you home. So yes, there are definitely going to be more outpatient surgeries and anesthetic stuff.
Okay, I want to end with one last question. I ask this to everyone that comes on the podcast, and we've had some pretty good feedback, but how do we innovate more within healthcare as a whole?
Yes, that's a thought-provoking question. I think the main challenges in healthcare in the United States right now are the economic ones. If you look at the numbers, every year the percentage of the gross national product spent on healthcare gets higher and higher and higher, and it's a trend that has to be slowed or halted because it's not sustainable. I'm not sure how to do that. The suggestion that they'll be able to somehow make a nationalized or some sort of health insurance like they have in European countries where the government supplies it, I think is unlikely to be successful in America for this reason. In America, people want special health care for themselves and the people that they love. They don't want to be told that their 78-year-old grandmother has to just die because now she's got heart failure or she's got a cancer. They want everything done. And to do everything costs money. And as I said, as the baby boomers get older, as the population gets older, and they inevitably get sick, when we throw a lot of technology and expensive medications, surgeries, hospitalizations, intensive care unit care at them, it costs a lot of money. So that value within the American culture is going to be an expensive one to fund. So I don't know how to answer that. I've had this conversation with many physician colleagues over many years, and I'm not sure how to handle that, but I think it's the main challenge in medicine. Every month we can pick up a journal and see that there's a new medication and there's a new procedure and there's a new device, and it's all very exciting, but I don't know who's going to be able to pay for it as the decades roll on.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
I mean, I wish I had an answer for that. Of course, when you bring people on the show, you want answers to the questions. That's another conversation, but I think that is the main challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to give an exact answer for that. I was talking with another guest on one of our recent podcasts. We were just talking about from even an idea perspective, finding better ways and new ways to do things within the hospital, healthcare professionals are at the heart of it. It just be cognizant, realize what might be a better way to do something else, and jot it down and share it. I think a lot of times when we have ideas, just a common human trait is, I need to keep this to myself. I don't want anyone to steal it. But when we're able to talk about our ideas, we share them with others, that's when they can really flourish. I think that applies for any industry.
I agree.
Well, Dr. Novak, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. How can people get in contact with you? Check out your website. Is that the best avenue?
It is. The website is easy to find because the anesthesia consultant is not that hard to remember. On the website, there's my email address and my even my office phone number, and I think my cell phone number might even be on there. I get contacts from people on a pretty regular basis from all walks of life. I enjoy it. I find every new medical problem is like reading a new mystery book, which is partly what inspired me to write one. But yeah, medicine's a fascinating profession.
You're certainly a rarity. Nice guy, super busy, and can always find the time to do things like this. So I really appreciate it, and look forward to hearing everything else that you continue to work on, and hopefully one day, maybe sometime this summer or in the next couple months, we can have you on again. Love to talk to you about some different topics. But thank you once again for coming on, and we really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Gary.
All right. You as well. Have a good one. Bye.
Wow, what a great episode. It was great having Dr. Novak on the podcast. Great content, great discussion. Everyone, be sure to check out his website, theanesthesiaconsultant.com. It's truly great, especially if you're into anesthesia. The content is for people that are into anesthesia and people that are looking to learn more about anesthesia. So it's definitely some great content. Please also be sure to follow us at Slice of Healthcare on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. For Twitter, we're at SliceofHC. And as always, please be sure to leave a review on iTunes in the podcast section. It helps us out, and we appreciate your feedback. Thanks, everyone. We're very excited for the episodes that are coming up soon. Have a great day.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast. The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.